This week on Making Contact.
I did almost 6 years of my life behind bars on a 2-year sentence. And most of the time that I spent behind bars was parole revocations, not the sentence itself.
The prison population in the United States is rising. So are the numbers of people exiting prison and trying to piece their lives back together. In fact, 3 million people will be released from prison over the next 5 years. On this Prison Desk edition of Making Contact, we'll look at the barriers former prisoners face and community efforts to support people reentering society. I'm Dara Nelson, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program creating connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Lack of rehabilitation programs behind bars and barriers outside of prison have created serious obstacles to successful reentry. Former prisoners are routinely denied jobs, housing, food stamps, child custody, and in many states, they are denied the right to vote. In California, lack of support helps to force 70% of parolees back to prison within 18 months of their release. But as Jong Ho reports, a unique program in Los Angeles is trying to improve the odds of staying out.
A new way of life is billed as a rehabilitation program for ex-prisoners. But to Shannon Brandeis, it's simply her new home in South Central Los Angeles. At age 34, she's working hard to overcome drug addiction and her past as a prostitute. Shannon still has the short dresses and knee boots she wore when she was working at a brothel in Compton.
I wore these. Okay, here's some of the little dresses that I wore.
She says she resorted to selling her body to feed her addiction, but her problems with drugs and alcohol had started long before.
Once I started using alcohol, which was at the age of 13, and then started using drugs, which was given to me by my parents, and you know, then the trouble started happening. I started off with marijuana, and then my mom started giving me crystal when I was 16, and but I had done it first with my boyfriend. I didn't do it first with my mom. But the marijuana, the first time I did it was with my stepdad.
Brandeis has been in and out of jail for drugs and prostitution too many times to count. The last time she went to jail, social workers placed her son in foster care. Brandeis says that forced her to seek drug treatment and stay clean in order to get her son back.
Every time before that, when I had went to jail, they never offered me nothing, told me to do nothing. It was just, you know, pay money or do your time. And I just did my time and then got out.
She went to an inpatient drug treatment center for several months. She graduated to an outpatient treatment program. And that's when she heard about a new way of life. The program includes two houses owned by the program's founder, Susan Burton. Burton herself has been in and out of prison for 30 years. She got clean a few years ago when she went to a drug treatment center in Santa Monica. It changed her life forever.
When I saw that just a loving, nurturing environment could help me begin to heal some of the pain, deal with some of the grief, support me through it, encourage me through it, well, I said, I got to do this in my community. So I came back here and I began to attend community meetings, and they began to educate me about what the prison system was. And when I saw I was a part of that, when I learned that the rate of incarceration for women had went up over 300% in the last 20 years, and looking at myself as a part of that percentage, wrongfully a part of that percentage, I said, this has to, you know, what can I do? You know, so what I do is just a little bit, a small contribution to ending a really, really humongous problem.
More than 100 women have lived here since 1998 when Burton opened her doors. She provides the basics that she needed, 3 meals a day, clothes, toiletries, and transportation. In exchange, residents must follow a few rules, be productive, go to work or school, and stay away from drugs and alcohol.
My name's Shannon. I'm an addict. alcoholic.
Hi, Shannon.
Residents attend Alcoholics Anonymous meetings every week at the house. It's the type of supportive environment that Shannon Brandeis says she needs to help her stay sober.
Sometimes you just need to let people help you, because if you don't, you're just going to end up in a bad place.
Though they haven't known each other long, the residents quickly become each other's family.
Are you comfortable here?
Yeah, are you?
Is this like home to you?
Yeah, this is right home. Is this home to you?
Yep, because I wouldn't be here.
That's 18-year-old Regina Buford, the youngest member. Though she spent the whole day watching TV, she's trying to finish high school. She aspires to become a nurse for the military. Buford has lived in a foster home since age 10. She found Susan Burton after leaving juvenile hall for the second time.
My mom, she's an alcoholic, and it's never, like, stable when I'm with her. It's always hard. So I feel that I have to do what I have to do to survive.
Like many of the women here, Buford is waiting to regain custody of her infant son, who's in foster care. This could be possible with the help of a social worker who specializes in prison populations, Dr. Marilyn Montenegro. She comes to the house regularly to help the women with their legal issues. Montenegro says parole rules and lack of help make it impossible for parolees and probationers, especially women, to change for the better.
Being on parole is sort of an extension of being in prison. When a person is on parole, they lose their civil rights. They are subject to being searched at any time by any so-called peace officer, a police officer, a parole officer. Anyone can search their body, can stop their car, can look in their car, can come into their place of residence without a warrant, can search them. People on parole can't leave the county that they're in without the permission of their parole agent. They certainly can't leave the state they're in, so they can't go see their family if their family lives in another state.
Programs like A New Way of Life that serve the needs of ex-felons are far and few between, according to Dr. Montenegro.
Some of them go into sober livings. Some of them are in drug treatment programs. Many of them are on the street engaging in illegal activities. There is not a lot.
Jerome Marsh is a parole officer with the California Department of Corrections. He says recidivism is because of a lack of will, not a lack of programs. In his experience, anyone who wanted to work was able to find a job.
Parolees overall are professional con men that are going to say what they think you want to hear and are going to be there with their hand out. Why can't you give me this or that or the other thing? And that's a habit that is very hard to break them of.
Marsh says he spends a great amount of time connecting parolees with social service programs. The corrections department contracts with homeless shelters to provide housing and job training.
Los Angeles County has traditionally the lowest return to custody rates of the entire state. And the reason for that is Los Angeles County has more resources, has food banks, has the Midnight Mission, has Salvation Army, we have the Weingart Center.
Joan Petersilia, a professor of criminology at UC Irvine, has studied criminal rehabilitation for 30 years. She's the author of When Prisoners Come Home, Parole and Reentry. Petersilia questions the efficacy of using homeless shelters to serve ex-prisoners.
Part of the problem is that you often get people who are not particularly qualified. So if somebody feels they have just a good heart, for instance, they may open up a house, but they may not have the training to actually work with hard-to-risk populations.
In recent years, it's been even harder to get help with food stamps, school loans, and public housing. In some states, depending on the offense, ex-felons are banned for life from benefits. They're barred from a long list of jobs. Petersilia says such limitations fuel the cycle of recidivism.
I've done a lot of interviews with inmates as they're coming home from prison, and I think there is an initial motivation to succeed for many of them, but then they hit the hard reality of what they're facing when you don't have a job and you don't have housing and you don't have money. Desperate situations result in desperate acts.
And the programs that address the needs of former prisoners are scarce.
We do have several reentry facilities, as they're known as, but they only touch about 10% of all prisoners leaving California prisons. So there are many. There are over about 20 of these facilities in Southern California. They usually house about 10 to 15 men or women, and they house them for usually about the first 30 to 60 days after they're released. But the capacity of these reentry facilities is so minimal that it hardly touches the problem. We have about 120,000 inmates being released each year, and as I said, only about 10% of them will ever go through a transitional or reentry or halfway house facility.
In contrast, women at A New Way of Life live there 6 to 9 months. Susan Burton had some live with her for more than a year.
They're a little bit more intense than the average recovering person. They have the things, the need to get back in touch with themselves, to reclaim the identity, to get through post-incarceration syndrome, to learn how to make decisions, to be, you know, encouraged through their mistakes and what have you. I guess we all need that, but it's a little bit more intense when you've just been walking through with no decisions and being abused through that, you know, system, through the penal system, so. Need some healing going on.
Without other kinds of assistance, parolees must rely on the generosity of people like Susan Burton and other nonprofits. For people like Shannon Brandeis, programs like A New Way of Life offer them hope and support they need to turn their lives around.
I hope to graduate my outpatient program. I hope to have my child back, be completely reunified with my child. I hope to have suitable permanent housing for myself and my child, and to be in full-time school. I'd like to go back to college, and I'd like to get my driver's license back. I know that sounds funny, but really, I really need my driver's license back, because these buses and trains are really hard, so... Those are the things that I wish to accomplish.
So far, Shannon Brandeis has managed to achieve one of her long-term goals, moving into a place of her own. She's continuing outpatient drug treatment, visits her son at his foster home every weekend, and expects to regain custody soon. In Los Angeles, I'm Jiang Ho for the Prison Desk of the National Radio Project.
We'll have more about former prisoners coming home in a few moments. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like a free information packet on this subject, please call us at 800-529-5736. You can also order an audio copy of this program. That's 800-529-5736. Or visit our website at radioproject.org. The so-called war on drugs has dramatically increased the imprisonment of people of color. As Sarah Olson reports, former prisoners with drug felonies on their records face particular barriers to reentering society.
Over half of the people in federal prison today are there because of drug-related offenses. In state prison, one-fifth of the people are there because of drugs. Historically, this has not always been the case.
The growth in prisons primarily in the 1980s was driven by the war on drugs. And in the 1990s, it's been less so, but it still continues to be a primary generator of persons being admitted to prison.
Ryan King is a research associate at the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project. When mandatory minimum sentencing laws were implemented, This new get tough on crime policy caused longer prison sentences and prevented judges from weighing individual cases.
If you look at the drug war, particularly legislation passed in the 1980s, mandatory minimums, very strict sentencing guidelines put in place, are exactly the type of policies that put more people in prison. They take away the judicial discretion, and how that has manifested itself is a significantly higher number of individuals going into prison and staying there for much longer, and the consequences on the communities where they come from has been devastating.
Judy Appel is an attorney with the Drug Policy Alliance. She says the so-called war on drugs discriminates against poor communities of color. According to the Drug Policy Alliance, 59% of people convicted of drug-related offenses are African American, and 22% are Latino. The government's own data shows that people in these groups do not use more drugs than other racial groups. So the question is, why are they convicted and imprisoned at disproportionately higher levels?
There's a real irrationality when it comes to drugs and to the treatment of drugs in our society. I think one piece of it is that there's been so much hysteria and PR and public images associating drug use and drug dealing with communities of color and with poor communities of color. And that has, I believe, really influenced the policies around the drug war. So that this is a way that the government is incarcerating huge numbers of communities that are already extremely stigmatized.
These public attitudes and penalties follow people convicted of drug felonies even after they've served their time. The barriers to re-entering their communities are uniquely harsh. In most states, if you've been convicted of a drug felony, you're denied access to low-income housing, you're not eligible to receive welfare, and you could lose custody of your children. There are also barriers to education. A 1998 amendment to the Higher Education Act prohibits people convicted of drug-related crimes from receiving federal financial aid to go to college.
The Higher Education Act itself is particularly important because if we really want our young people to find economic alternatives, to be engaged, to be able to take care of themselves, to have families someday and take care of their families, we should be encouraging them to seek out higher education, to go to college, to get trained, and to be able to get good jobs. And it's very difficult to be able to do that if you can't have financial assistance, particularly because so many people who are caught within the criminal justice system are low-income people who can't afford their own education. So the Higher Education Act itself is really targeted at poor people who are caught in the criminal justice system and really tearing down opportunities for them to get out of their current situations or current patterns of activity.
According to Appel, these policies are not just barriers, but are racially motivated denials of service, which look starkly like the Jim Crow laws of an earlier era.
The analogy is made because of the fact that so many of the people who are actually targeted by the drug laws are people of color. These collateral consequences, these secondary consequences, this disenfranchisement is yet another way to further disassociate the communities targeted by the drug laws, the communities of color, from engaging in civic involvement. You can't get housing because you have a felony drug conviction. That's very similar to not being able to get housing because of your race. You can't have access to the same services as other people based on a factor that is very tightly tied to race and to class.
The civic involvement Appel refers to is also limited by denying felons the right to vote or disenfranchising them. In 48 states, people in prison are denied the right to vote. In 33 states, people on probation or parole are disenfranchised. And in 12 states, a felony conviction results in a lifetime ban on voting. Ryan King says that although felony disenfranchisement has existed since the founding of the United States, after the end of the Civil War, it was used as a tool to prevent newly freed slaves from voting.
We can't talk about disenfranchisement without talking about the fact that in a country where 1 in 3 black males born today can expect to serve some term in prison during their life, the similarities to slavery are frightening and they should give us pause.
Kamaya Masharia from Grassroots Leadership in South Carolina and others like him are concerned. as former prisoners, they're taking action and educating each other.
Different states have different policies. Some places, when you get out, you have to go get a pardon from the governor in order to be reinstated and your citizen rights reinstated for you to vote. In some places, just such a lengthy paper process that people really don't even bother, nor did they even let you know. When you release, they don't even let you know what your rights are. You don't know if you can vote or not. So those are some of the things that kind of hinder people.
King says this lack of knowledge and access affects entire communities.
When we think about disenfranchisement in African-American communities, we don't want to just think about the numbers. We don't want to just think about the 4.7 million people that are disenfranchised in general, or the portion of those that are African-American and disenfranchised. We also need to think about the communities where those 4.7 million Americans live and understand that in the communities where there is concentrated disenfranchisement, even the persons who are permitted to vote in many cases will not, because there's not a political culture, or when they do, their political voice is diminished because so many of their neighbors, family, friends are prohibited from voting.
Whether it's the right to vote or to get an education, the struggles of people re-entering society after prison echoes the racial discrimination and the community activism of the civil rights era. For the Prison Desk of the National Radio Project, I'm Sarah Olson. I don't wanna be no movie star, and I don't wanna drive no fancy car. I just wanna be free to live my life, to live my own.
Between 1980 and 2000, the number of parolees returning to state prisons exploded by 652%. In California, 4 out of 5 people are sent back to prison, not for committing a crime, but for a technical violation of parole. Correspondent Chanel Patrick files this report.
I did almost 6 years of my life behind bars on a 2-year sentence. And most of the time that I spent behind bars was parole revocations, not the sentence itself.
Tommy Escarcica has been in and out of prison for the last 20 years. Her experiences in prison led her to form Proyecto Common Touch, a legal resource for women of color on parole. She says the parole system is broken and full of bureaucratic errors. In her case, although her home was in San Francisco, she was paroled to Oakland. This is her story.
I kept going back to prison because I was paroled to the wrong county. And I had a very, very bad report, to say the least, with my parole agent. So every time I went across a bridge over to San Francisco, and she thought that I might stay over there over 48 hours, she put out a warrant for my arrest. So every time that I went to report for parole, I got arrested at the parole office.
According to Title 62 of the U.S. Criminal Code, the purpose of parole is to, quote, provide a means of supervising and rehabilitating offenders without continued incarceration, and a means by which prisoners can be aided in the transition from prison to society. However, former inmates feel that society is waiting for them to fail instead of helping them to succeed.
Parole has lost its whole focus and purpose. The original purpose and intent of parole, as, quote, they wrote it, is not only for public safety, but to reintegrate and assist the parolee.
Like Tommy Escarcega, Dorsey Nunn is a former prisoner whose experiences in prison led him to a lifelong career of social activism. He helped to found All of Us Are Nunn, which is a national initiative of prisoners and former prisoners combating discrimination. He agrees that parole has lost its focus. He says that before prisoners even get out of prison, they are set up to fail. In 1976, California began a nationwide trend of abandoning flexible prison terms and replacing them with fixed sentencing guidelines. Now, prisoners don't have a chance of early release based on their good behavior, and prisons have reduced their training and rehabilitation programs.
We had a dramatic change where we removed words like rehabilitation from the purpose of incarceration. So like when you get out of prison, most people say, you're supposed to have been rehabilitated. And in the meantime, we didn't change what we go to prison for as a primary purpose. The primary purpose that we send people to prison for in the state of California is punishment.
When people leave prison and start their parole term, they have a long list of responsibilities to fulfill in order to maintain their freedom. They are required to find housing,
terminate association with felons, even if they are friends or family, complete drug and alcohol treatment programs, as well as submit to random drug testing and keep regular appointments with a parole officer. The parolee must also find and maintain employment. Dorsey Nunn says that most job applications ask whether or not someone has committed a felony, and this makes it difficult to even find a job.
So we can go down to like that little thing, that fantasy thing. When you got out, you could have got a job at McDonald's or Jack in the Box. Have you seen the application? You know, and the application say, have you been convicted of a felony? In fact, the only place that exclude that question is the state of Hawaii.
Nunn says having a felony conviction does not make a person less qualified to do most jobs.
You know, because I actually think that I'm qualified to be a dog catcher. And I noticed that the question is on the application for the SPCA. So I want to know what stopped me from being a qualified dog catcher. I want to know what stopped me from being a qualified person to actually work in a funeral home.
Many critics argue that unions, such as the politically powerful California Prison Guards Union, have a vested interest in longer prison sentences and tougher parole requirements. More returning prisoners means more jobs. In communities where there are few employment opportunities, this is a powerful argument, and private companies, like the Corrections Corporation of America, are welcomed employers.
If we didn't fail, they wouldn't have jobs, so they have an investment in that particular system. We can say we actually return more people to prison for technical parole violations than any other state in the system. So whether they succeed or fail, I'll probably think about it, is the incompetency and the incompassion of people that work in the system. They have moved over the course of the last 20 years from being an intermediary that helped people to seeing themselves purely as law enforcement. What happens when the crime rate drops and you still want to enlarge a union? The way that you would do it is actually return people back to prison for technical violations, because what their jobs are based on is the number of people that they have in prison.
For the Prison Desk at the National Radio Project, with Dara Nelson, I'm Chanel Patrick.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks for listening. Special thanks to Myra Chachkin, Linda Evans, and Christopher Sprinkle for production assistance. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Additional music by Dead Prez. Making Contact is an independent production funded primarily by individual contributors. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in mass media. If you'd like to support our work, or if you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. For a cassette or CD copy of this program, number 2904, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736 and ask for your free listener packet. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director. Amy Pomerlow, director of production and training. Justin Beck, associate producer. Susanna Hines, associate manager. Brishin McKee, office manager. Peggy Law, founding director. Norman Solomon, senior advisor. And I'm your host and Prison Desk coordinator, Dara Nelson.